my parents would say, "Go back and work it out. You'll be fine." "You'll be fine" was an expression I heard again and again as I grew older. We'd all meet up and make a day of picking blackberries in a neighbor's yard, riding our bikes along the lakefront, making up games, and building elaborate blanket forts with folding TV tables and chairs in my grandmother's little front room. Most of us loved to play tennis, and Aunt Anne, as I called her, and my dad would often take us to play in Lake Meadows or Dalton, Illinois. In Iran, I had been an only child, so entering into this close society of so many children was a wholly new experience for me. Being alone was natural, even comfortable for me. I never felt lonely. I simply developed a rich fantasy world as a way of entertaining myself, always perfectly happy to wander around alone or play with the dogs, chickens, or donkeys on the compound. Now, suddenly I was rarely alone, and after the initial shock of all the new faces, I began to appreciate that I had the best of all worlds. Built-in playmates when I wanted them, yet I still enjoyed the attention and benefits of being an only child. Our extended family lived as one unit. The parents all parented one another's children, which often worked to the children's advantage. Forum shopping is a legal term that refers to the way lawyers seek out the most favorable jurisdiction in which to file a claim in an effort to secure the judgment they want. This was exactly what we kids would do. We would forum shop among the adults. If you wanted sympathy and to be told you were absolutely right no matter what, you went to Aunt Laurinita. If you had a mechanical or electrical problem, Uncle Lester was your guy. If you were sick, my dad was on 24-hour call. If you wanted tough love and the hard truth, you went to my mom. Advice about boys? Talk to Aunt Anne. There were adventures to be had with Uncle Gene, who rounded up all the kids and took us to the Indiana Dunes. We never knew if we would return home that night or days later, as sometimes happened, no doubt to the other parents' delight. Uncle Lester made hamburgers with potato chips on Saturday nights for whoever wanted to come. The Cook family ate dinner during the week at 4:30. I'd often eat there and then go home for a second dinner with my parents. My grandmother always had a pot of soup and a pan of gingerbread ready in the winter. And on weekends and during the summer, we kids always just slept wherever we were at bedtime. We thought we were getting away with what we wanted by forum shopping, but unbeknownst to us, our parents were always communicating to ensure that important information did not slip through the cracks, and that they never contradicted one another. Well, almost never. Puddin' was the heart of our family. Everyone loved Puddin'. And because she traveled often with my parents and me, and she and I always bunked together, perhaps that's why I felt a special bond between us. Looking back, my guess is that she made each of her grandchildren feel she loved us the best. She embodied all that I could hope a grandmother is supposed to be. I trusted her completely and could confide anything in her. Absolutely anything. Nothing seemed to shock her. She was hip and always wanted to know the latest, whether it was gossip or dance moves. Not long after we moved to Chicago, after an argument with my mother, I announced that I was going to run away from home. "Don't go without your undershirts," my mother replied, which took me by surprise. Why wasn't she trying to stop me? And why was she helping me pack, I thought. Then she watched me march out of the house, knowing full well there was only one place I would go. And off I went with my little suitcase, directly to Puddin's house around the corner, because where else would I go? I knew I could count on Puddin to sympathize with my outrage and protect me from her daughter. Puddin lived by the firm belief that grandparents and children are bonded by a common enemy. I stayed for a couple of hours eating my favorite snack of Ritz crackers and cheddar cheese. Then my mom showed up, took my hand, and without a word, walked me home. How did she know where I was, I wondered. No matter what happened, Puddin was always on my side, offering steadfast love and support. She encouraged us all to be kind to one another, showing us countless times by her example the meaning of love and forgiveness. When my cousins and I squabbled, she would force us to make up. She believed there should only be room for goodness in our hearts. And there was plenty of warmth. Literal warmth. Having learned needlepoint, knitting, and sewing from her mother, Puddin' taught me the same and would sit in her little front room, knitting afghans for her children, grandchildren, and great-nieces and great-nephews. She gave them to my generation as gifts when we graduated from high school. That way we could take them off to college with us and still have a way to wrap ourselves up in Puddin's love on cold winter nights. I still have mine and my former husband's. Even now, a quarter of a century after her death, whenever I drive by her old home, I look up at the window in her little front room and feel comfort as I imagine that I still see her sitting there. Puddin's home was more than just a safe and loving place in the present. It was also our link to the past. The walls and side tables were lined with well-preserved black and white photographs in ornate, beautiful frames. There were pictures of great aunts and great uncles, great grandfathers and great grandmothers, our whole family tree going back as far as her memory could trace it. In the living room, Puddin' even had a certificate of office commemorating the elected tenure of another of my great-great-grandfathers, Victor Rochon. Born in 1843 in St. Martinville, he was one of the first black legislators voted into the Louisiana House of Representatives during Reconstruction. He'd given a famous speech in 1890 denouncing Louisiana's Separate Car Act, a state law that would codify segregation in rail cars. He asked the other members of the legislature whether it made sense for the black nannies to be able to accompany their children in all-white train cars, why he, a fellow senator, could not ride in those very same cars. He lost the argument in the state legislature, and in 1896, in a landmark case, Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of racial segregation. I used to linger in Puddin's home, looking at the photos, trying to imagine the history my relatives had lived through, from slavery to Reconstruction to the Great Migration, where they made their way north to the oppressive streets of Chicago and endured the Great Depression and two world wars. But in spite of any hardship, education was always, always viewed as a path to success. There were my great-aunt and great-uncle Helen and Jean Dibble, who'd saved to send their five children to New England prep schools because the quality of education in the high schools in Tuskegee, Alabama, was so poor. There was Ella Smith, my great-great-grandmother, who attended Oberlin when it was still a seminary before the Civil War. There was my great-great-aunt, Edna Boutte, who received a degree in pharmacy from the Sorbonne in Paris, and another degree in social work from the New School in New York City. All the siblings and cousins of my mother and father's generation finished college. Given my family's history, and explicitly from my parents, I always knew the expectations of me were high. From a very early age, as I was told the stories behind all the photos on Puddin's wall, I was taught that achieving your dreams was possible with a good education, a strong moral compass, a loving family, hard, honest work, and a lot of good luck. At times, those expectations made me believe I could accomplish whatever I wanted, and at times I felt I could never live up to them. My mother was not an easy act to follow. At Sarah Lawrence College, she toyed with the idea of an art degree before deciding to study labor law, a degree for which she was required to do field work with the women of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. The only thing I learned, she would later say, was how to drink gin out of a paper cup. She went on to work at a social service agency in the Bronx, which was a true education. Having been raised in a stable, loving home herself, she was shocked at the way children who fell through the cracks were being neglected and abused. She then took a course in child study, working in a nursery school, and eventually earned a teaching certificate. Returning to Chicago after graduation, she married my father and accepted a job as an assistant pre-K teacher at the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools, referred to as the Lab Schools, a nursery school through 12th grade private school affiliated with the University of Chicago. Started in 1896 by a progressive education leader, John Dewey, it served as a laboratory to test new ideas in the classroom. She was only the second Black teacher ever hired by the school. While teaching, my mom finished her master's degree in education at the University of Chicago, beginning what turned out to be a lifelong career in early childhood development. She loved that the discipline combined the intellectual rigor of understanding child psychology with the abundant opportunity to give lots of love and snuggles. In Iran, my mother taught social science at the nursing school while also tackling what was, to her, the most important child development project of all, me. I loved my father dearly, but from my earliest recollection and throughout my childhood, my closest companion and the person I worshipped above all others was my mother. Tall and naturally pretty, she never wore any makeup save for red lipstick and generally had little interest in fussing over her appearance. When it came to my development, my mother set high but attainable benchmarks. According to her, by age 3, I could sit still and have a long conversation like a big girl in 2 languages, English and Farsi. After spending time with new friends from France, I added French to the list. Thanks to my father's encouragement, I could also read by the same age. I had an even temperament, too, able to tag along on my parents' grand adventures without too much complaint or discomfort. The only challenge was that if I didn't eat regularly, my mood could turn ugly, so my mom always carried chocolate bars in her pocketbook for me to nibble on. Puddin' would always carry peppermint candy. While my father was a tireless optimist, my mother's encouragement always came with a reality check firmly attached. "Yes, you can do anything," she seemed to say, "but never underestimate what you're up against." I was more like my father. He always hoped for the best, but my mom always planned for the worst. Nowhere was this more evident than in her attitude towards money. My mom says being raised during the Great Depression made her appreciate the value of every dollar, or perhaps I should say, penny. To say frugal would be an understatement. Considering visits to the hair salon to be a total waste of money, she always opted to wear her hair up from her face in a very practical traditional bun. Anytime my father or I have tried to treat us to a nice restaurant, she's incapable of enjoying the meal without opening the menu, shaking her head, and saying, "I could make this for a fraction of the cost at home." Her clothes, while simple and elegant, have always been purchased on sale. Always. Her constant refrain is, "You are simply throwing money away if you pay full price." Even today, at 90 years old, she still drives 5 miles to Costco every single week to buy what her exhaustive research shows is the cheapest gas in Chicago. When I show her a new dress I bought, the first question she asks me is, "How much did it cost?" "Tell me if you like it first," I always say. "Whether or not I like it depends on how much it cost." My parents debated issues all of the time. It was the family sport. But the only real argument I remember them having was over the lottery. My father played the lottery every week, which to my mother was a waste of money and time. One week, the lottery had a particularly large jackpot, and my parents started arguing about what they would do with their imaginary winnings if somehow they ever actually won them. For my dad, it was a no-brainer. He would buy a luxury condo in the Four Seasons Hotel George V off the Champs-Élysées in Paris. Meanwhile, my mother's fantasy about this money revolved largely around how much of it they would have to pay in taxes and save for me to have for a rainy day. She said a Parisian condo would be expensive to maintain and eventually leave them bankrupt, like so many other people who win the lottery. This discussion then spiraled into raised voices, both of my parents visibly angry, until my mother, furious that her husband would jeopardize our future with his ludicrous condo idea, finally stormed off upstairs. all over money that they didn't win and would never have. I just shook my head at the whole exchange, knowing that before the lights turned off, they would have worked it out. That was their rule. Never go to bed angry. And they never did. Barbara was always a master planner for every hypothetical disaster possible. In Iran, she was always acutely aware of what I ate or drank, knowing how ill the wrong fruit or drink could make me. She meticulously washed and peeled or boiled every single item that went into my mouth. She trained me to do so as well. At the age of 3, while dining at a fancy restaurant on a trip to the United States, I said just a bit too loudly, "Is it okay to drink the water here?" My mother was also fairly cool and reserved. She would always hug and kiss me, especially to say goodnight, but she was not one to be verbally demonstrative with her affection. She says she believes people overuse the word love, throwing it in at the end of every phone conversation, trivializing it. But I suppose I miss that spoken affection because I say it to my daughter at the end of every phone conversation and whenever else the spirit moves me. My mother was also always the one to point out a flaw, downside, or risk in attempts to tamp down my unrealistic enthusiasm a bit. Her characteristic reply when life didn't go my way would be, with a shrug, "You'll be fine." When I was young, I thought that my mother lacked confidence in me. It wasn't until I was much older that I began to appreciate that she was just afraid of disappointment for me and for her. She believed in me, but she also felt it was her duty to toughen me up, force realism on me, and protect me against life's heartache by always reminding me just how horribly things can go wrong. As a black woman who'd spent her life growing up in Chicago and being one of the only in elite white institutions, she knew a thing or two about being let down. The mantra of my parents drilled into me was that to be successful, I would have to work twice as hard. They never finished the sentence, but I knew what they meant, twice as hard as white people. No matter what grades I received, my parents asked, "Did you give it your best?" If I complained that I'd given it my best, but the grade wasn't fair, they responded, "Life isn't fair. You don't always control what happens to you. You can control how you respond when life doesn't go your way. Be resilient and you'll bounce back." Working hard, sadly, was not a prerequisite for advancement at South Kenwood's Shoesmith Elementary in the early 1960s. With Chicago's segregated black schools being as overcrowded and underfunded as they were, the bullies waiting for me outside posed a far greater challenge than the schoolwork I faced. The overcrowding forced some of the students to have classes in the hallway, and there were never enough books to go around. By 1963, my parents, who wanted to support the public schools, had reached their breaking point. Shoesmith had a revolving door of teachers who tried and failed to address the conditions in the classroom. My fourth grade class had 30-plus kids combined in one room with third graders. I had 7 teachers that one school year. It was chaos. That spring, the last of the 7 took me and 5 other kids aside and told us we didn't have to do homework anymore. We were the smart kids, and apparently the teacher thought she could stop teaching us in order to concentrate on the other children in the classroom, teaching to the norm. I ran home overjoyed, and I told my parents, "The teacher said we'd never have to do homework again." "Well," my mom said, "I guess that's the end of that." At the end of the year, my parents transferred me to the lab schools, where my mother had worked in graduate school. Since I was so young, my parents decided I would repeat fourth grade with actual homework this time. By the end of my 3rd year of high school, my parents had coaxed me to go to the same prep school my mother and 4 of her Dibble cousins had attended, the Northfield School for Girls, which by that time had merged with the neighboring boys' school, Mount Hermon, to become Northfield Mount Hermon, NMH. I was reluctant to go and stay for 2 years, wanting to graduate with my classmates in Chicago, but I relented because they told me if I graduated from high school at age 16, I would only be allowed to go to a small women's college. That was out of the question, so off I went, and attended classes on NMH's beautiful, sprawling, hilly campus in Massachusetts. My stay was made easier by the fact that my cousins, Tony Cook and Rojan Dibble, were also there, and Rojan's sister Kyla joined us our second year. Since my cousins and I had grown up inseparable, none of us were ever really homesick. I will confess that at the lab schools, there were more than a few classes and semesters where I could skate by doing the minimum necessary to earn good grades so that I could be a typical teenage girl playing bid whist in the cafeteria before school and talking to boys on the phone. But after a couple of months at NMH, I realized that the work was much more challenging and that I better buckle down and start working harder if I wanted to get into my top choice for college, Stanford University. As college approached, my father wanted me to go to the University of Chicago so I could be closer to home. My mother wanted me to attend her alma mater, Sarah Lawrence. But I'd had my heart set on Stanford ever since a day at the end of my freshman year when I was standing in the library at the lab schools and this handsome, tall, older guy walked in. Mr. Poole, the librarian, recognized the young man and told me to stick around to meet him. His name was John Hope Franklin, Jr. I didn't know him, but I did know his father, John Hope Franklin, our neighbor, a good friend of my grandmother, and the famous historian whose pioneering book, From Slavery to Freedom, A History of African Americans, sold millions of copies worldwide and became the text often credited as laying the foundation for the future academic field of African American studies. John Jr., a lab school alum, was back visiting his old stomping grounds on spring break, and Mr. Poole mentioned to me that John was a student at Stanford. "I love Stanford," John said, barely glancing up at me. "You should go there." That was all he said, and that was all it took. For the remainder of high school, I was determined to go to Stanford. After I shot down my parents' recommendations, my father naturally told me I could do whatever I wanted to do. My mother, of course, told me I could apply, but since Stanford was so competitive, I would need a backup plan in case disappointment struck. She made me apply to 8 additional schools varying in competitiveness. Then I talked to my NMH guidance counselor about my first choice. "Don't waste your time," he said. "You won't get in." How could he just dismiss my dream? Was he saying that because I wasn't smart enough? Because I was black? Because I was a woman? After reeling for a moment or two, I decided I would just have to prove him wrong, and I applied anyway, and to all 8 backups to satisfy my mom. I was accepted to all of them. With my acceptance letters in hand, I marched back into his office and I laid each letter on his desk, one at a time, saving Stanford for last. "I got into 9 schools," I said, "including Stanford, thank you." "Congratulations," he said, barely looking up from his desk. Decades later, I told my mom what the counselor had done. She was appalled, but hardly surprised. Back in Chicago for the summer, for some foolish reason, I decided that after being away at prep school for 2 years, I was too mature to have my parents take me to college. I was going to go and move in by myself. My mother didn't seem surprised since nobody had taken her to college either and acquiesced to my request to go alone. Of course, the headstrong girl who insisted on going off on her own, who had walked into that counselor's office with such defiant swagger, was still, underneath, shy and often filled with self-doubt. I'd gotten into Stanford, but was it a mistake? Was affirmative action a factor? Did I belong there? I'd never visited Stanford or spent any time in California, and as my departure date approached, I became more than a bit nervous. As I packed up to leave, folding the new Afghan Puddin had knitted for me into my suitcase, my mind turned where it often did, and still does when I'm facing a new challenge and don't know how it'll turn out. I thought about all of the photos and portraits in my grandmother's home, and all that my people who came before me had accomplished. I thought about Victor Rochon and the speech he gave in the Louisiana House of Representatives, about my grandfather and his ambitious work with the Chicago Housing Authority, but mostly I thought about my great-grandfather, Robert Robinson Taylor. How had he, the son of a slave, summoned the courage to leave home and take the long, lonely train ride to what must have seemed like a foreign land to study at MIT? How had he handled the responsibility, knowing that the tuition his father, Henry, had invested in him was such a sacrifice? How was he treated by his white classmates, most of whom likely had no prior exposure to black people as a peer? Reminding myself that they had been through far more difficult times and not only survived but thrived, I said to myself, "Come on, Valerie, you can do this." And that became my mantra whenever the seeds of self-doubt crept in. Right before I left, my ever-frugal mother sat me down and said, "Look, I know you're going to want to have fun, and you'll be tempted from time to time to cut class. If you do, this is what it will cost Dad and me." Then she handed me a piece of paper where she had worked out a breakdown of how much tuition they were spending per class, not how much per semester, but how much for each individual class for every hour and every day. "It has and will always be a given that we support your education for as long as you want to go," she continued, "but do not throw our money away." I knew I couldn't let them down. I hugged my parents goodbye, and off I went by myself. Chapter 3. The Best Laid Plans. I pulled up on Stanford's campus on a beautiful, sunny California afternoon with two huge yellow suitcases I'd shoved onto a shuttle bus that picked up the other students who were traveling alone at the San Francisco airport. As we wound through the campus to my dorm, my eyes tried to absorb the massive palm trees, swimming pools, and tennis courts, the buildings with red-tiled roofs tucked behind perfectly landscaped yards with tropical flowers. It didn't look like any college I'd ever seen. It looked like a country club. The bus dropped me off at Lagunita Court, a cluster of residential halls, one of which had been renamed from Oliva Magnolia to Ujima, the Swahili word that means extended family, because half of its residents were black. It was a time when the civil rights activism of the 1960s had catalyzed the Black Power movement of the 1970s, and with it, a sense of pride took hold. Black houses were cropping up at predominantly white colleges and universities across America, not because black students wanted to be separate from white people. After all, the students had chosen to go to those schools instead of historically black colleges. They just wanted to have a close association on campus with other black people. I'd applied to live in Ujima over my parents' objections. "You don't need to go to Stanford to live in a black house," my mother said. "You grew up in a black house." But my parents' generation, having spent their lives trying to get out of segregated black spaces, didn't understand what their children were going through. High-achieving black kids, many having spent our entire lives feeling somewhat isolated in predominantly white places, were longing for a sense of community and solidarity. Those who grew up in predominantly black communities also felt the black houses eased the transition from home. At the end of the first day of orientation, the dorm leader gathered the freshmen from all the dorms at Lagunita Court, which included Ujima, for a talk. "I want to go through the rules," he said. After 2 years at NMH, with its many rules and restrictions, I'd come prepared with a little notebook and pen. I took it out, ready to write down his instructions. "There are none," he said. "Welcome to Stanford University, 1974. My thoughts were heaven, but lingering somewhere in my subconscious was the knowledge that what he was saying didn't fully apply to me or any of the other black students in Ujima. There are always rules for black people in predominantly white spaces. We had either been explicitly warned about, or we just knew intuitively that there was very little margin for error. I carry the responsibility of an additional set of expectations as well. The fact that generation after generation of my family had overcome enormous obstacles to succeed, and my parents had made sacrifices so I could have the opportunity to be on that campus, was never far from my mind. My time at Stanford wasn't much different from the years I'd spent at NMH. In fact, most of the courses seemed easier. I worked hard competing against myself to earn good grades because it gave me a sense of accomplishment. I always assumed I'd be a doctor just like my dad, but a high school anthropology class piqued my interest too. I ended up majoring in psychology because I earned my highest grades there, and also because, after 6 weeks of organic chemistry and a visit to my medical school boyfriend's anatomy class where he was dissecting a cadaver, I decided pre-med was out of the question. I found many of my professors to be inspiring, but nothing triggered a true passion for a particular career. Perhaps the fact that my parents provided me with infinite possibilities made it harder for me to zero in. When the sky's the limit, it can be overwhelming. By my senior year, I still didn't have a clear sense of direction. I suggested to my parents that I take a year off to travel, as some of my classmates planned to do. "And who's paying for that?" my mother scoffed. She told me she was worried if I stopped going to school, I'd never go back, and a bachelor's degree was simply not going to open enough doors on its own. "So pick a graduate school," she said. I signed up for the GMATs, thinking I might go to business school, but then there was a great party the night before the tests. I stayed out too late, and in the morning thought better of it. Who was I kidding? I wasn't going to business school. I was good at probability and statistics, but back then I didn't have any interest in business. I skipped the test. Then, one weekend, I drove up to San Francisco to see my best friend, Gwen. Gwen had been a junior when I was a freshman, and I'd met her the first day I arrived at school, introduced by her boyfriend, whom I knew from the lab schools. She'd grown up in Los Angeles, and I'd spent many long weekends and each Thanksgiving holiday with her family. By the time I was grappling with career choices in my senior year, she was in her second year of law school at UC Hastings College of Law in San Francisco, and she loved it. I was crashing on her couch one weekend, lamenting my lack of direction, and she said, "Try law school. Even if you don't love it, it'll buy you some time, and if you don't end up practicing law, it's still a good degree to have." Gwen had never led me astray before, so I sat for the LSAT, scored fairly high, and started applying to various law schools. I was accepted at the University of Michigan very early in the process, before I'd even submitted all of my applications. At that time, Michigan ranked number 2 in the country. I couldn't believe I'd gotten in. After the shock wore off, I decided if I was good enough for Michigan Law School, then Michigan Law School was good enough for me. When my grad school decision was made, I decided that it was time for me to stop moving aimlessly through life, that what I needed was a sense of order and direction, a linear path. So one evening, I made myself a checklist of the goals I wanted to accomplish in the next 10 years. My plan was this. 1, graduate from Stanford. 2, graduate from Michigan. 3, discover my career passion. 4, fall in love and marry. 5, have a baby. 6, be a fulfilled, satisfied, and happy wife and working mom. I was convinced that if I could just have the discipline and self-control to accomplish items 1 through 5, then I would be able to check off item 6. So I graduated from Stanford. 1, and packed myself off to Ann Arbor to check off 2. I prepped for law school by reading Scott Turow's terrifying 1L, The Turbulent True Story of a First Year at Harvard Law. Turow had been my teaching assistant in a first-year writing course at Stanford, and I thought he was terrific, so I believed every word he told. The Socratic method of calling on students in lieu of traditional lecturing gave me shudders. There were no lawyers in my family, and when I arrived at Michigan, I knew nothing about the law other than what I had read in Scott's book or seen on Perry Mason. First semester, we were required to take a class called torts. What was a tort? It was terribly intimidating for someone as shy as me. On 1, both my criminal and property law professors went down the list alphabetically, and thanks to my last name, Bowman, I was called on in both classes. When I heard my name, my cheeks began to burn a deep red, an awful reflex triggered whenever I was forced to speak publicly. The students who always aggressively raise their hands first were called gunners. I hesitated before answering in both classes, and as I saw hands shoot up all around me, I thought to myself, how do they know the answers so quickly? After day one, I wasn't sure there would be a day two. A high school classmate from the lab schools in Chicago was 1 year ahead of me at Michigan. She laughed with a knowing expression on her face and said, "Don't worry, it'll get better." I wasn't so sure. It was brutal at first as I struggled to learn this whole new language of the law, res ipsa loquitur, the rule against perpetuities, mens rea, and the statute of limitations. But I discovered that I really enjoyed legal writing, the order and logic of framing an argument. I also excelled at it, so much so that in my second and third years, I was selected to help teach first-year writing. When it came time to explore my career options, I flirted with the idea of going to Washington, D.C. I clerked for a D.C. law firm the summer after my second year, but didn't really enjoy the work. A sign. Then, during my third year, I interviewed with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, and a few other federal agencies that came to campus to recruit. But D.C. was definitely a company town. During the summer I spent there, nearly every lunch and dinner conversation I had revolved around one topic, politics, which I thought might get boring quickly. In the end, I realized I was homesick. Including my time at boarding school, I'd been gone for 9 years, and I was uneasy about settling permanently away from my family. So I decided to return home to Chicago after I graduated from Michigan in 1981 and became an associate at Pope Ballard Shepard & Fowle. The firm's offer was certainly attractive financially. The starting salary was $30,000 a year, and I couldn't imagine what I was going to do with all that money. In the early 1980s, women at big firms tried to make our appearance and attitudes conform to that of the men. We wanted to blend in and be taken seriously. It began with our attire. On my first day of work, I wore a dark blue suit with a white silk blouse. I abandoned the blue silk ribbon that was intended to be tied around my neck. That was simply a bow too far. When I arrived, I found that Nancy Yaley, the other woman in my class who began work the same day, had shown up in the exact same outfit. We clicked immediately, laughing about how ridiculous we looked, but we knew we had to play by their rules. Walking in, I knew I'd be judged not just by my gender, but also by my race. Not long after I started, I found out that the only other black associate at the firm had failed the bar exam the year before. Failing wasn't going to be an option for me. I threw myself into my studies to make sure I passed the bar, petrified of what the white lawyers would think, not just of me, but of other black lawyers if I failed too. Thankfully, I passed. At first, having my own office and assistant was exciting. But reality seeped in quickly. As much as I tried to gin up some passion for corporate law, the work grew tedious fast, and it was hard pretending I was as devoted to it as the guys in my practice group appeared to be. Filing articles of incorporation, doing due diligence by reviewing volumes of documents for banks before they formed holding companies, and drafting registration statements for the offering of stocks, yuck. And the partner who supervised us was a real stickler for details. Not, I discovered, my long suit. I started to venture more into the firm's real estate practice, and that was relatively better. I thought I had finally found my path, and having checked off items 1 through 3 on my tenure plan, I realized I'd left one off, and I made a mental note to amend the list. After husband and baby, I added, mistakenly, make partner at Pope Ballard, Shepard & Fowle. That step, I knew, would simply be a matter of working hard and staying focused. That I was confident I could do. The open question at that point was having a family. In order to have a baby, I needed to marry. In order to marry, I needed to find a husband. and I knew that for me, finding a husband wouldn't simply be a matter of finding a husband. I had to find the husband, meaning the one I thought would be the perfect one for me. In June of 1982, my family and nearly everyone we knew spilled out of the University of Chicago's Rockefeller Chapel into a warm and sunny afternoon. It was the day of my cousin Kyla's wedding. Kyla's dad, my Uncle Gene, had spent weeks driving around Chicago with a stack of Xeroxed wedding invitations in his car, handing out additional ones to nearly everyone he knew, so the guests filled every pew in the massive Gothic-style church. Everyone lingered outside the chapel for a while, enjoying the sun for a moment before heading to the reception four blocks away at the university's International House. I was chatting with several of my cousins, laughing at how Roshan, Kyla's sister and maid of honor, had dropped the ring as she handed it to Kyla during the ceremony. It hit the marble floor and pinged down the aisle, sending a ripple of gasps and giggles through the whole congregation. As we rehashed the episode, Earl Dickerson, Uncle Earl as I called him, emerged from the church. Uncle Earl was a grandson of a slave. At 16 years old, he stowed away on a train to Chicago, where he eventually attended the University of Chicago Law School and married Catherine Mims, Puddin's best friend. Although my parents were not at all religious, Puddin was, and she believed I would go to hell if I wasn't baptized. So the first time we visited the United States when I was about 7 months old, she snuck away to have me baptized without telling my mom, asking Catherine to be my godmother. Puddin later confessed what she'd done, and my mom, always a pragmatist, shrugged. "I don't believe in any of that stuff," she said, "but Lally can't have too many people looking out for her." And indeed, I grew up enjoying great love and affection from both Aunt Catherine and Uncle Earl. But on that day, the focus of my attention wasn't Uncle Earl. Rather, it was the very handsome young man escorting him, Bobby Jarrett. When my parents were growing up, the black middle class in Chicago and D.C. was small, so small that it seemed everyone knew everybody. No matter where they went, if two people were black and in a certain social stratum, they could find someone they knew in common in 2 seconds flat. When I started to bring boyfriends home, Puddin would always say, "Well, who is he?" Which meant, "Who are his parents or who are his grandparents?" She assumed that the tight-knit community she and my grandfather had cultivated for their daughters would continue through my generation. But when she asked those questions, my cousins and I always cringed. Just as many black people had moved out of segregated communities as soon as they were able, my generation rebelled against any limits imposed on our social life. And although in school my boyfriends had always been black, I had no interest in limiting my choices to those with family connections and backgrounds similar to my own. But Bobby Jarrett was an exception. I'd had a crush on him since I was 8. He was 4 years older than I and went to Catholic school, so we hadn't socialized much growing up. But our moms grew up in the Rosenwald Building together, and our dads were both members of the Boule, a professional fraternity for prominent black men. Bobby and my cousin Jeff had also both been altar boys at church. Whenever my grandmother took me with her to church, I'd watch Bobby saunter down the aisle, pretending to look pious, but with a mischievous twinkle in his eye. And that was enough for me to develop totally unrequited feelings for him. One time in college, I sat in front of him at midnight mass on Christmas Eve, and when I worked up the nerve to turn around to say hello, I saw he was holding hands with the woman sitting next to him. I was heartbroken. Standing in front of Rockefeller Chapel that day, seeing Bobby Jarrett made me hope that maybe now he would notice me. Uncle Earl walked right over to me with Bobby in tow and greeted me warmly. And Bobby, who'd never given me a second glance before, did the same. My cheeks began to flush. I was so smitten. I swiftly ditched my cousins and joined Uncle Earl and Bobby as they walked to the reception. Uncle Earl, then in his 90s, set the pace, and we strolled along slowly beside him. I noticed how attentive Bobby was to Uncle Earl as he engaged him in one of his favorite activities, sparring over the news of the day. Bobby held his own, which was no easy task. Uncle Earl had argued and won a case against the racially restrictive covenants before the U.S. Supreme Court, a ruling that had paved the way to open up previously segregated neighborhoods, such as South Kenwood, for black residents and homeowners. Uncle Earl was an outstanding lawyer who loved a good debate, and as I would soon discover, so did Bobby. After we sauntered to the reception, much to my disappointment, Bobby, Uncle Earl, and I were almost instantly separated in the enormous crowd. Later in the evening, Bobby and I bumped into each other in the hallway just as I was about to leave. He casually took my hand, looked me right in the eye, and said, "Do you mind if I call you sometime?" "Oh, yeah, sure," I said, doing my best to appear nonchalant. "Call me." Unlike so many of the boys I dated, Bobby felt comfortable, like the boy next door. His father, the famed syndicated columnist Vernon Jarrett, was a larger-than-life figure who began his groundbreaking career in journalism at the black-owned weekly paper The Chicago Defender, but later became the Chicago Tribune's first black syndicated columnist, known for unsparing views on politics and race. He went on to become an op-ed writer for the Chicago Sun-Times and was one of the founders of the National Association of Black Journalists and the NAACP's Afro-Academic, Cultural, Technological, and Scientific Olympics. Bobby's mother taught first grade in a poor-performing Chicago public school, where she often dipped into her own pocket to buy her students school supplies and books that they couldn't afford. Her goal was to make sure every child finished the grade knowing how to read. She and my mom shared a passionate belief in the importance of early childhood education and how disparities in its quality could influence life's trajectory. In college, Bobby apparently liked to party a little too much, and when Vernon Jarrett received his son's poor grades, he pulled up to the Nashville campus of his son's school, Fisk University, in a stretch limousine. "Pack up and get in the car," he said to his son. "Where are we going?" Bobby asked. "Home to Chicago. Right now. The party's over." Bobby straightened up, graduating from Chicago's Roosevelt University and then going on to med school at the University of Illinois. He still liked to party, but his passion for medicine motivated him to be more serious about his studies. We reconnected just as he was starting a surgical residency at Mount Sinai Hospital on the west side of Chicago, and I liked the fact that he was a doctor like my dad. When men say they'll call, they usually mean they'll call sometime before they die, while women assume they mean they'll call within the next day or two. I certainly did, and I'd almost given up on hearing from Bobby when he finally called about a week later to invite me on our first date. Dinner at Uncle Earl's home. Not exactly romantic, but I would have said yes to any offer. Bobby and Uncle Earl seemed to pick up their debate from the other day, and it continued late into the night. Watching them going at it reminded me of the spirited conversations around my parents' dinner table. Having spent so much of my life enjoying time with Puddin', I was also attracted to the fact that Bobby could have so much fun with one of her contemporaries. Even though Bobby's work schedule was brutal, 12-hour shifts and being on call all night every third night, we started seeing more of each other. Bobby was outgoing, a little irreverent, smart, funny, and always the center of attention in any room he was in. Like my father, Bobby was very well-read and loved to discuss books of all topics, from black history to Greek philosophy. His book collection was rivaled only by his record collection. He had eclectic tastes from classical music to jazz, and other than holding up with a book, Bobby's favorite activity was attending the opera. Although I didn't care for the opera, my parents enjoyed it as well. A man who felt so familiar, who was outgoing, and who enjoyed the simple pleasures of being with my family was just what I wanted. Bobby seemed perfect. As 1982 gave way to 1983, Bobby and I planned to spend our first New Year's Eve together. It was a holiday I usually detested because of the unrealistic hype and the large impersonal parties. But this year, with Bobby, the occasion finally made sense. Instead of standing around awkwardly at midnight without a date at some big overblown party, We had an intimate dinner with my cousin Jeff and his wife Lynn and two other couples who were close friends. As we laughed and talked over good food and champagne, I thought, this is how New Year's Eve is supposed to be spent, with people you truly love. That night, I made it my New Year's resolution that we would be married before the next year came around. Bobby not only seemed right for me, but also fit nicely into my plan of becoming a successful lawyer, falling in love, getting married, and having a baby, all by the age of 30. 2 weeks later, after dinner at my parents' home, while I was driving Bobby home down South Lakeshore Drive, without much context or romance, he nonchalantly proposed, and I said yes. By the time my dad and I arrived at the church on my wedding day, September 3, 1983, I was very nervous. Unlike Bobby, my shyness and aversion to being the center of any group's attention had not faded through the years. In the church basement, while we were waiting for the ceremony to begin, one of my bridesmaids, Judy Brown, started reeling off one dirty joke after another, and as embarrassing as it was, because my dad was right there, it lightened the mood and helped me relax. After my seven bridesmaids, don't ask, walked down the aisle, just as I was set to follow them, I hesitated for a moment. My dad patted my arm and said, "Just remember, everyone here loves you. Look directly at them as you walk, and you'll be fine." And he was right. I still remember the expression on the face of Puddin's good friend, who we called Mama Hazel. Her face lit up when I caught her eye. She winked, and I began to breathe normally. Then came the vows. I always cry at weddings, even at weddings in movies. But standing there at the altar with Bobby that day, even though I'd been scared I was going to break down and ruin my makeup, I didn't. I didn't shed a single tear. Never even felt the urge to fight them back. Nothing. It was probably some kind of sign or red flag, but I didn't have time to dwell on it, as I was then whisked away to our wedding reception, 400 people in my parents' backyard, a two-hour receiving line, 90-degree heat in the long-sleeved satin dress with precious tiny buttons down the back that my mother had been married in before me and her sister before her. In the beginning of our courtship, and through most of our engagement, Bobby had been all charm, as we so often surrounded ourselves with family and friends. But as we spent more time alone together, the charm subsided. He was never angry or mean, just aloof, distant. His excuse was that he was always tired, which was plausible given his demanding schedule, so I was never terribly concerned, but clearly it had registered. We honeymooned in St. Croix, where Bobby's godmother gave us 2 weeks' use of her home as a wedding present. On our first night, Bobby jumped into the swimming pool without remembering to take out his contact lenses. Out they popped, and we spent the next 2 days with me driving Bobby around the island looking for an optician who could replace them. Not exactly a seductive start. Then came the sunset. I love sunsets. Always have and still do. Back then, I thought there could be nothing more romantic than watching the sun set over the ocean with my one true love. On our third day in St. Croix, when Bobby could see again, we set off for a drive to the west side of the island, arriving just in time to watch the bright yellow sun drop into the ocean. As we walked along the water's edge, Bobby walked about 10 feet out into the water to look down at a school of bright, translucent fish swimming all around. He called out for me to come look, and then, just as the sun melted into the horizon, he shifted places and blocked my view of it. And my only thought was, if I could just move him out of the way. Again, like my tear-free vows, not a good sign. If only I'd been paying attention during our courtship to who Bobby really was instead of who I hoped he would be. But I was too determined to make my fanciful notion of the perfect marriage come true. After the honeymoon, I threw myself into trying to be the perfect wife, reenacting the daily rituals of the happiest marriage I knew, my parents. Although they enjoyed their big circle of family and friends, my parents spent almost all their time together. They didn't even like to be in separate rooms. My mother loved to watch her favorite chefs, Julia Child and Jacques Pepin, on cooking shows. My father did not. Yet, he sat in his favorite chair and suffered through countless hours of her shows just to be by her side. And they never went to bed angry. That was a household rule. No one was allowed to go to bed without resolving an argument, sealed with a kiss, no matter how angry you were. It wasn't such a hard rule for my parents to follow, since they never really fought. Even today, the argument about the imaginary lottery winnings is the only one I can remember. And if my parents were my role model for a successful marriage, my model for a successful husband was my dad. There was so much to admire about him. I got a kick out of the fact that he always wore bow ties long before they were in fashion, and I was so proud that he would rush to the hospital when someone in our large extended family had an emergency, of which there were many over the years. My father was very romantic, and demonstratively so. Every Valentine's Day, he gave my mom the mushiest card he could find, which he would then read out loud to us. He enjoyed the theater of a dramatic delivery with deep emotion and making everyone laugh, despite my mom's standard less than enthusiastic reactions. My mom, who's pretty reserved and pretends to be uncomfortable with overt displays of affection, would always shrug him off saying, "Oh, Jim, those cards are such a waste of money." But secretly, she loved that he loved doing it. Their love was an unselfish love. For a long time, I took it for granted that the way my dad treated my mom and me was how all men who professed love would behave. When they didn't, I was not only surprised, but very, very disappointed. After working all day, I would rush home to our duplex on Cornell Avenue and cook dinner, just as my mom had always done. But unlike my dad, who was home like clockwork every night before 6, Bobby had an erratic schedule, and he never called to say when he was going to be late. I often gave up waiting for him and ate dinner alone. On the evenings when he did come home, Bobby began a nightly ritual of gobbling down his home-cooked meal and then headed down to the basement. He would spend the entire evening down there, surrounded by his books and records. He put on a headset, leaned back on the couch, and either read or close his eyes and listen to music, slowly making his way through a bottle of wine. We hadn't lived together before the wedding and had only dated for about a year, so I wasn't sure if this behavior was just a temporary result of the stress of his residency or if this was actually the man I had married. The longer it persisted, the more upset I became. I felt like his behavior was a rejection of me. Blocking me out to the point of wearing headphones was not passive-aggressive, but aggressive. We argued about it a lot, or rather, I argued a lot. Bobby wasn't really a fighter. He preferred to evade. The harder I pushed, the more he withdrew. The mistake I made in trying to imitate my parents was that I defined myself as an us, not recognizing that my parents were also each whole as individuals. I expected Bobby to make me whole, rather than being my own person and giving us space to come together. "You work so much," I'd say. "You're never here, and when you are here, you're not really here, at least not for me." "I don't know what you mean." "Come on, Bobby, drinking wine by yourself all night while I'm upstairs alone, that doesn't seem normal to me. What's going on?" "I'm tired. I'm working so hard. I just need to unwind. This is how I unwind." Yet whenever we were out to a party or someone's home for dinner, Bobby was his normal life-of-the-party self, which only served to confuse me more and make me feel inadequate. "You're a fake," I accused him. "You're not the person you pretend to be with everyone else." Fighting didn't help, and I tried everything else. I tried giving him his space in the hope that it was a phase and he'd come around. I'd putter around the house trying to find little chores to occupy me, like doing laundry or paying the bills, waiting for him to come to me. No luck. I tried planning date nights in the hope of coaxing out his old gregarious self. That didn't work either. Then, a last-ditch effort One of my cousins had given me sexy lingerie during my bridal shower. It was very low cut in the front and plunged down to, shall we say, my lower back in the rear. I slid into it and went downstairs to Bobby's cave. Then I leaned against the door framed seductively in some ridiculous pose I'd probably seen in a movie, and I asked him if he was coming to